This is Droops, and this is episode 19 of Twat Radio. Now with my cable, I'm able to get... Alright everybody, today I'm going to be reading a chapter from Electric Universe by David Badonis. It's a damn good book. I read a chapter on Infonomicon before, and I actually emailed David Badonis and asked, hey, can I read a chapter? And he said, yeah, go ahead, have at. And I think that's really awesome. And I want everyone to make sure their local library buys this book so you can get it, and you don't have to pay for it. And with the library having it, more people can be exposed to the book. Or come to my house, borrow my copy. It's a little well worn. Anyway, this is chapter 3 of Electric Universe. It's called Thomas and JJ, New York, 1878. Bell's work in the 1870s was the start of a great outpouring of new discoveries. A proconsul from Roman Empire suddenly transported to the muddy swampland of the American settlement of Fort Dearborn in the year 1850 AD, a little before Bell's work, would not have been especially surprised in what he found. There were horse-drawn vehicles and wooden houses, and candles or oil lamps to hold back the night. The few telegraphs that might be found in big cities had scarcely changed the quality of daily life, but if that proconsul had returned a single lifetime later, in 1910, that muddy town would have exploded to become the city of Chicago, and amid the cars, electric lights, and telephone poles, where powerful electric charges were led whirring around at immense velocities, our time-voyaging proconsul would have been utterly startled. The second generation of transformations was begun by individual inventors such as Bell. But as the 1870s went on, an increasing number of discoveries were made by larger groups of researchers, working in a new style of industrial research laboratory. They were the ones who produced the generators and streetcars and motors and lighting systems that created modern Chicago and other great metropolises around the world. Running these big research labs required a different personality than that of General Alec Bell. The research directors had to understand electricity, of course, but they also had to be willing to work on assignment and not worry too much what those assignments were. Thomas Edison was the most powerful of these new industrial research chiefs, and one of his great successes came in 1877 when he accepted an important assignment to crush Bell. The world's largest telegraph company, Western Union, had been watching what Bell was doing, and even before his final model was ready, they tried to get him to leave a prototype overnight at their New York headquarters so they could examine it. Bell was a trusting man, but not that trusting. He kept the prototype secure in his own hotel room. Once he had his patent, more direct measures were needed, for who was to let an upstart undercut a giant industry? Certainly not William Orton, the head of Western Union. His strategy was almost embarrassingly simple. America, after the Civil War, was a violent place. Strikes were often resolved with rifles and dynamites. Patents were stolen. Fledgling investment houses were destroyed by established firms. It wasn't surprising that within the technology field, predators had begun to appear, generally bankrolled by rich financiers. When they had identified a new electric product, they would try and find a technological mercenary skilled enough to produce the same device using a slightly different process. The original inventor would be destroyed. The company that had arranged for the copy and the mercenary who produced it would become rich. Because Bell's telephone threatened to undermine the entire telegraph business, Orton had to get the most skilled enforcer he knew. This was the young Thomas Edison, a man who, as Orton happily explained to a friend, had a vacuum where his conscience ought to be. Edison was almost exactly Bell's age, but from a very different background. Instead of the parents and uncles and education in Scotland and London that Bell had, Edison had a father who once whipped him in a public square. He had left school in Frontier, Michigan when he was barely a teenager. He'd supported himself as a telegraph operator for years, sleeping in cheap hotels and rooming houses across America. This would have been hard enough for any 15-year-old, but Edison was also very hard of hearing. When he wanted to hear a piano properly, he'd have to get a piece of wood, bite down on it, then push the wood as hard as he could against the piano. "I haven't heard a bird sing since I was 12 years old," he once casually remarked. When he got married, young, he ended up with a woman with whom he soon found he had almost nothing in common. When he tried his first legitimate invention, a quick vote-counting machine for legislatures, he found that he was laughed at. Everyone in the know understood that legislatures didn't want their votes to be counted quickly. By the time he reached New York, he was resentful, and he was poor, and he was bright. Just the man to coldly undercut another man's work. In time when he would redeem himself, but not yet. There was a flaw in Bell's work, and Edison accepted Orton's assignment to attack it. Bell's design depended on sending vibrations of the human voice into a microphone to start the electric current that would run through the wire stretching from one telephone to the next. But to get the signal to travel more than a few hundred yards, you had to yell, and the signal often died or became too feeble to hear it when it got more than a few miles away. Edison thought about it and saw that there was a way to keep electrical signal going as it traveled further through the phone wires. Before anyone had exhaled into the phone, he had a dedicated battery pump a strong, steady electric signal through the wires. When the speaker began to talk, his breath had only to modify the already robust battery signal, making it a bit stronger or a bit weaker. The result was that the speaker's voice didn't fade so quickly, and phone messages could be sent dozens of miles. Orton was delighted and paid off Edison with the equivalent of several $1 million in today's money. But Orton's delight didn't last long, for although Bell was meek, his new father-in-law was not. There were lawyers hired, leaks to the newspaper. It's possible there were some quiet threats to Orton. Bell ended up keeping the main phone patents, although Western Union got some income from the improved microphone. None of this mattered to Edison and his team, for Edison's stint as a patent breaker had led him to think more about the way Bell used the resistance in a wire to modify a moving electric current. Other devices, he realized, could use the same twist, and indeed, on October 30th, 1878, J.P. Morgan wrote to a Paris representative, "I have been much engaged for the past several days on a matter which is likely to prove most important to us all. Secrecy at the moment is so essential that I dare not put it on paper." The subject, of course, was Edison's electric light. Edison liked gruffly pretending to his friends and to visiting newspapermen that he was just a simple man who had no interest in anything more than patching together a few practical devices. But this wasn't true. When someone smart enough to duplicate or improve an important invention, as Edison had done with Bell's telephone, he's usually smart enough to wish to come up with important insights of his own. Edison had tried to read through Newton's writing as a youngster, but he wanted to make an original contribution to the new world of electricity, in which his technical skill had allowed him to get rich. An effective light bulb would be a good start. For decades, researchers had dreamed of making a practical artificial light, but none had come close to succeeding. Anyone who had watched a cast-iron stove knew that the heated metal glowed first red, then orange, and finally it might even glow white. If a piece of metal could be connected to a battery and heated up that much, it would produce light. But how to make the glowing metal last long enough to be useful? This is what no one had managed. The microworld was so little understood that it was hard to control how electric power jumped out when it was tapped. As early as 1872, the Russian Alexander Lodzin had placed 200 electric lamps around the Admiralty dockyards in St. Petersburg. But when he switched them on, they burned so powerful that the metal filaments melted in just a few hours. The lure of electric light didn't go away, though for the oil or gas lights were the best alternatives, had problems of their own. Great groups of whales had been destroyed in the early 1800s to get relatively clean oil for lamps. When that got too expensive, kerosene and other heavier oils were used, producing, however, smoke, smells, and when the lamps were knocked over, fires. Natural gas was a little better, but it was expensive and hard to pipe for any distance, and users had to keep on adjusting their lamp burners to keep streams of soot from billowing out. The first metal that Edison considered for his electric lights was platinum, since it has one of the highest melting points of any metal known, but it's also one of the most expensive metals known, and pretty soon he moved on to cheaper ones. At one point, thinking he might succeed with heated nickel wires, these didn't burst into flames as much as his previous drives, but even when it glowed, the light was too strong. Owing to the enormous power of the light, Edison jotted in his notebook. Suffered the pains of hell with my eye last night from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. Got to sleep with a big dose of morphine. In time, he managed to build the nickel wire lamps without staring at them, but they still burned too fast. A colleague recalls one of his first demonstrations to Wall Street backers. Today I can see these nickel wire lamps rising to a cherry red, like glow bugs, and hear Mr. Edison saying, "A little more juice," and the lamps begin to glow. Then there's an eruption and a puff, and the machine shop is in total darkness. The first trick Edison used to keep the filaments from burning out was to stop any oxygen from getting to them. That meant surrounding them with little vacuums. He bought pumps that would pull air out of glass containers. He hired the top glass blower, and he improved the pumps, and before too long, in there in his rural New Jersey laboratory, his team had created small glass containers in a shape that reminded onlookers of turnip bulbs, our light bulbs, that had less air inside them than is found on top of Mount Everest, or even several hundred miles higher above the earth. By late 1879, he had a small glass bulbs that held barely 1/1,000,000th as much air as ordinary atmosphere. They still didn't work. Any metal filament Edison put at the center of one of these bulbs got so hot it would burn or melt or crack, or despite the low air pressure in the bulbs, just sizzle along to failure. He realized he had to try something other than metal. All right, I think we're getting a little long in the twat here, so I'm going to fold down the corner of the book, and maybe we'll continue that on my next twat that I do. But it won't be me for a little while. And then, at the end of the week, we've got Freak Nick. So be watching out for that shit. Anyway, I've been Droops. That's Twat Radio Episode 19. Website's twatech.org. My email is droops@infonomicon.org. And I think that's about all I've got.